Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. From Love Poems Delivered on Clay Tablets to the Art of Letter Writing to Telegrams and Email, John Freeman has chronicled the ways in which humans have corresponded through the ages. In a new book titled The Tyranny of Email, he examines how the age of electronic information has reduced our time for leisure and contemplation and separated us one from another. Freeman is a former president of the National Book Critics Circle. This month, he was named editor of the literary magazine Granta. He's in the studio to make a plea for more selective, nuanced, and sociable communication. I'm sure there are many of you who'd like to join us. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. John Freeman, good morning to you.
Thanks for having me.
I love the dedication of this book. You say, "This book is for my grandmother, who wrote the most wonderful letters, and for my mother, who taught me how to reply." Talk about some of those letters your grandmother wrote.
Well, whenever I got a gift from my grandmother, my mother would instruct me to write back. And that was not the end of the correspondence, but usually the beginning. And she lived up in the Finger Lakes, my grandmother. And she would write me back and just describe her day. So she would go down to the lake and throw some rocks into the lake. She had her pet, Charlie the Chipmunk, and she would describe what Charlie was up to. She would describe the friends who would pass by the house for a drink, who she had for dinner. And it was just the most wonderful way to spend time with her without being with her. And the way that she wrote to me, it sort of taught me how to become a person and eventually an adult. Correspondence isn't just about sort of sharing what happens in your day or other information. It's sort of, especially to a young person, it's a way of teaching them how to have manners in some cases, but also just how to experience and observe the world. So I miss those letters quite a bit.
Now, were you actually writing her back with thank you notes?
Yeah, we started a correspondence, and not long ago, I went up to the Adirondacks to visit with my parents, and before she died, she gave all the letters I'd written to her over 15 years to my father. And he brought these out and showed them to my girlfriend, which was quite amusing because along the way, I think I discovered that I wanted to be a writer. And so I was sort of pillaging the dictionary for words and using them in the most inappropriate and funny ways. And so I remember I signed off a letter to her describing what I was taking in my classes in high school and this and that. And I said, "I hope this letter has been voluptuous enough for you."
Well, you know, I was about to ask at what age you began corresponding with her.
Quite early. I mean, I must have been about 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. And we wrote letters up until the end of her life, which was last year.
I see.
And, you know, I see that as we psychologists have discovered that we see our lives as stories, as narratives. And the nice thing about letters is that they move slowly and they have space and they have a kind of texture to them that almost novels do. I mean, a lot of the early novels were epistolary novels made up of letters. And the Bible, many of the books of the Bible are written as letters. And I think there's a speed at which the mind works, which moves with the hand and travels at the speed of letters, and that I sort of miss now that people don't send letters quite as much.
Now, you using email?
Yes, I used it this morning. and it's you have to use email. I mean, the main office of the magazine I work for, Granta, is in London, and I'm obviously here in D.C., and if I were to try to correspond by letters, we could probably only put out 2 issues a year. So there is quite a bit of work that I have to do over email.
But you're suggesting that there should be room for, time for, handwritten letters.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're on vacation and you've just been out on a day and you've seen the Grand Canyon, or you're in Rome and you've just seen the Spanish Steps, and you get back to your hotel room, why would you go down to the business center and log on to a computer to send something instantaneously when you can pull off a sheet of paper with the hotel stationery and use your own hand and give someone sort of a gift?
A gift.
I mean, because when something comes as a letter, it has all kinds of textures to it that an email is sort of devoid of. And when you send an email now, given how much email people get, it just piles into an inbox, which is already overflowing.
So you feel, as your title suggests, that we have fallen under the tyranny of email.
Yeah, we email when we don't have to. We email when we shouldn't. We email when we have lots of other ways to communicate. Send a postcard, send a letter. Until quite recently, you could send a telegram, and there are still a few specialty shops which send these newfangled things, you know. And you can pick up the phone, or you can just meet someone in person. You've probably had this experience where you play email ping pong back and forth, and you don't get much out of it. Whereas if you just set up a coffee date, sit down with someone for 30 minutes, you could have so much more out of the communication.
You know, you're awfully young to be thinking this way, one would assume, because of your involvement in the book world, your involvement in the field of letters, that you would be very much into and on with email because of its speed, which is why people use it.
Yeah, but this, speed in a perfect device is not a problem, but nothing is perfect. You know, no system is perfect. We're not perfect. So ultimately, it becomes destructive. You know, things break down. Miscommunications pile up. And I've just had too many experiences where email takes on a kind of life of its own, and 50% of emails, the tone is misunderstood. And that piles
up. That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. That happens a lot, especially within a workplace.
Yeah, and it's dangerous. I mean, because you could just walk down the hall to your coworker's office and say, have a conversation, you can make eye contact, your speed of your voice has certain meanings, the inflection of your voice, your face, your body language, what you're wearing. There's all these different things that are involved in face-to-face communication that are stripped away when you're typing over email. All you have is the text. And, you know, writers work their entire lives to be able to try to get people to perfectly understand what they're meaning when they write a sentence or two or a whole novel or a poem. But most of us aren't writers, and even writers are misunderstood. So it seems to me that the important thing is to use email when you have to, but to use these other ways of communicating, because otherwise, you know, we're going to have flame-ups in the office and flame-ups at home, and it's not a good situation.
John Freeman, his new book is titled The Tyranny of Email, The 4,000-Year Journey to Your Inbox. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us with a tweet or a message on Facebook. When you went back to your home in the Adirondacks and you looked through this many-year record of letters that you had written, that your grandmother had kept, what did you learn about yourself?
I think one of the things I learned is that when you correspond with someone, they are, to a certain degree, a mirror. And that can be a good thing and a bad thing. And in the case of my grandmother, is a wonderful thing, because I wanted very much to please her. I wanted her to know that I was working hard and that I was learning. And that when she wrote to me telling me about who was visiting the club at the lake and what the riverboat was doing and giving me the kind of rhythms of her life in Skaneateles, New York, where she lived, it kind of forced me to do the same thing about where I was living at the time, which is Sacramento, California. And it was a million miles away to me. And it, it it made me realize that writing letters as much as reading is it's sort of an act of the imagination. And that by looking at the world around you, you sort of create a kind of narrative about it and a story about it, and you sort of situate yourself in it in a way that I think requires slow communication. And one thing I really treasure about that correspondence is my mother was a kind of mediator, because she wrote letters too, and she was a wonderful letter writer like her mother. And one of the reasons I dedicated this book to her is that she lost her ability to speak in the last 5 years. And I don't think I would have written this book were it not for that. And she also lost her ability to write. And that silence is for me, is deeply painful. Mm. And I realize that I'm spending all this time emailing and texting and tweeting. And to what extent, you know, is it, it's like that Shakespeare line, is it sound and fury signifying nothing? And so it forced me to think about, you know, there is a limited amount of time we all have in this world. And our time is getting even more compressed with the people that we love and that we keep up with. And so what's the best way to make use of that? And what's the best way to communicate? And to me, I just discovered, you know, I got to start writing letters again, because I do have every letter that I've ever received, dating back to the love notes I used to get in fifth grade that were passed.
You really have kept them all.
Yeah. No, I really do.
Oh, marvelous.
They're all stacked up in the closet up in my parents' house in Utica, New York.
And nobody's keeping your emails.
Well, think about how many times you've had a computer crash. I've had 3 in the last 10 years, and they have just wiped out correspondence.
John Freeman, his new book is titled The Tyranny of Email. We'll take a short break, then your calls, comments. Stay with us. Welcome back. At the center of John Freeman's new book, titled The Tyranny of Email, The 4,000-Year Journey to Your Inbox, is a manifesto for a slow communications movement. Describe what you have in mind, John.
I think we have this idea that technology always means progress. And one of the great problems of email and other forms of computer-mediated communication is the speed. Biologically, I don't believe we can keep up with the machines that are now supposed to extend and make our lives more efficient. So I think we need to step back and get some core principles. And the first one is that speed matters. The speed at which you do something matters. More accidents happen on freeways if you raise the speed limit to 100 miles an hour. Planes get terrible turbulence. If you play a record back at twice the speed, it's going to sound horrible. And I really don't think communication is any different. So the speed at which we communicate matters. It means that we have a smaller frame of reference. It means we're doing things more quickly. We're thinking less. We're reacting. And so I think we need to step back and say, everything does not have to happen at terminal velocity. There are some things that we can put aside and do more slowly, and we'll actually do better if we do them that way. Another principle is context matters. The speed at which we're communicating is creating a world of no context. And we have so many things in our lives, especially in the media now, where it's so speeded up that it's very hard to step back and get a larger picture. For example, during election, conversations happen which have happened in previous elections, and strategies are brought up. And the speed at which our media moves now makes it so hard to say, wait a second, this has happened before, we've covered this. And I think the same thing happens in terms of our correspondence. We need to have a larger frame of reference, which is why when I wrote this book, I didn't just make it entirely about email. I said, let's go all the way back to the earliest communications and see how written words moved. And they moved quite slowly. And, you know, finally, I do think that we need to have an idea of where we want to go and make a movement out of this, because there are technologies which have been introduced and then we've tried very hard to pull them back. The nuclear weapon. Email is not a nuclear bomb, but there are things that we invent that we have to exert our agency over. I mean, if humans have any difference between ourselves and mammals or insects, it's because we have the ability to make a moral choice. We can decide to do something. And so I think we need to decide to make a decision to slow down. It's that simple.
Now, here is an email to take a little question with you. It's from Peggy. She says, I'm 70 years old. I can spend hours, as I did yesterday, in front of my computer on email and Facebook communicating. I have a new iPhone, and that even keeps me close to my technology. The only way to talk to my grandchildren is by texting. Old-fashioned phone calls do not elicit any response. Even email doesn't get a response anymore.
I have friends like this who you have to text. They don't check their voicemail at all. I would suggest writing them a letter, because you get so few letters these days that they really do matter. When you receive a handwritten letter or a note from somebody, it's really a gift. And I think the only way that we're going to change the manner in which and the speed at which we're communicating is to try to bring back old methods. And I don't say this as a Luddite. I text, I use email, I have two cell phones. The other thing that you can do in this situation, if it's this woman can actually go, is to go and visit. And then the challenge will be, are they texting while you're talking to them? Which, if you've ever talked to teenage kids now, it's miraculous how they can have three conversations going at once.
But if they're opening an envelope and reading a letter, surely they can't be texting at the same time.
No, I mean, it's like opening a gift. A letter is like a gift. It's wrapped like a gift. It's got all the sort of brocaded textures of a gift, and there's something really irreplaceable about it, because it is a thing, and you don't throw letters away or notes away. You keep them, and I think that would be the way to really get their attention.
Tell me about turning back the clock and whether it's really possible, because though it's currently email and iPhones, it's going to be something else.
There will be something else. And I think the thing which will really gain momentum about slow communication is when people realize that it will give them back time, that the time that they spend texting and emailing is actually creating more text and email. I mean, because if you send an email to someone for work and say, can you do this? And they write back, and then you write back, and then they write back, and you say, okay, thanks, and they write back, thanks. It's sort of every email in some ways creates six more emails.
You're right.
So if everybody who feels overwhelmed by email, because some people don't, and, you know, they should continue living as they do if they're happy. But I think there's a lot of people who feel overwhelmed, who feel like there's never enough time in the day, who feel like their day starts before they get to work because they're emailing, and it never ends because they're emailing at night in their bed or waking up in the middle of the night and emailing. those people should simply stop sending emails. Not entirely, but there are many emails you don't have to send. And if you don't send an email to someone else, that means that they don't get an email, that they don't send you back an email. So the benefits of it will multiply quite quickly.
Tell us about Granta.
It's a British literary magazine. It's sort of the New Yorker of London. It was Cambridge University's student literary magazine until the 1970s. Two Americans went to Cambridge on a Fulbright, and it was about to go out of print, and they brought it back. And instead of making it just another student magazine, they made it into a broader kind of global literary magazine. And this was the late 1970s, and lots of American writers who weren't that well known in England had not actually even been published there. And they also felt, this is Bill Buford, who went on to become the fiction editor of The New Yorker and wrote a book called Heat, which is a really wonderful book, and Jonathan Levy, who's a novelist. They felt that the style and energy of American writing at the time was a huge kind of breath of fresh air, because England was falling into this sort of chronicling of the end of the British Empire, and realism was a dominant storytelling method. And yet there were all these Americans who were doing exciting things, and so they made the first issue of this British magazine, New American Writing. And it got people's attention, and from that date, 1979, 30 years ago, when your show started, they continued, and they had themes to every issue. And so they got England's attention by naming the 20 best British writers under 40, which included Ian McEwan and Kazuo Ishiguro and Pat Barker and Martin Amis, and this huge sort of talented group of British writers. And they continued to publish American writers in that mix, but they broadened and added memoir when it wasn't being treated as a literary genre, travelogue, and long-form reporting. And I think that's the sort of format of the magazine now. Is we don't have word count length, so unlike other current interest magazines, you won't find very short stories because we don't have the ad space for it. We can run things that are quite long. It's not contemporary in the sense, so we always come at stories from the angle, from a refraction point of memory and personal experience. Mm. And it's exciting, our new issues on Chicago.
Are you fairly young to be the new editor of Granta?
Originally, when it was relaunched, I think Bill Buford was in his late 20s. So that puts me at an older point. But I think the last editor was in her 40s. And before that, Ian Jack, who was this terrific journalist from Scotland, was in his 50s. We're in a new point. We're in a polyphonic world where languages merge and cultures are colliding. And it feels like a time to have some excitement around the magazine. And I think we've sort of got that into this new issue, which is out now on Chicago.
Good, good. All right, we've got many callers. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call this morning, and thanks for the delightful conversation. I really enjoyed listening and learning about your book. I just have a small anecdote to share. Your conversation really hit home for me this morning. I had my boyfriend, now fiancé, was in the armed services and went off to boot camp. And as you probably well know, when you're in boot camp, you can't use the phone, you can't text, you can't even email. And so after being together for some time and having all of those ways of communication at our fingertips, we had to kind of rediscover the letter. Mm-hmm. And every Sunday he raced to the mailbox to see if there was anything from me, and I did the same. And interestingly, just last night, I was sort of going through some old boxes and sorting things, and I found the stack of all of those letters that we wrote back and forth, and that was just about 5 years now. So we kind of got to share those letters together and relive where we were in that time and how our relationship has evolved and the stories that we told to each other. So I totally echo your thoughts that it's something that we need to rediscover. And in fact, I feel sort of inspired by the event last night to find writing again.
That's a wonderful story.
Isn't that terrific?
Love letters there's a reason why I kept these love letters from grade school and high school is because there's something so personal and intimate about it. And I've actually done this in relationships when you're at a distance, there's something you can dial in to the most thoughtful part of yourself sometimes when you're at a distance. And I often think of Chekhov and his wife. They lived in different cities and they would write letters back and forth. And sometimes distance isn't a bad thing if it allows you to share part of yourself, which isn't readily apparent in face-to-face or person-to-person conversation. And that thoughtfulness, I think, can go such a long way to sort of helping a relationship go to another level.
Grow.
Yeah.
John Freeman, his new book is titled The Tyranny of Email, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Lavernia, Texas. Good morning, Marianne. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for taking my call, Diane.
Sure.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make a little comment. It kind of is the same thing the lady before me said, but I try to always send a little handwritten note, even if it's just half a page. Cards, I buy cards, and sometimes I white out the inside thing and put my own a little letter in there. And also my granddaughter, I send her a lot of cards. She's only 3 years old, but she loves them, and she's always calling me, "I got a card today, Granny." But going back to his keeping all his old mail, I have letters that I received from my mom and my grandmother when I was 19. I was married the first time. I had moved to Houston, which is 3.5 hours away, and back then the long distance was not as, easy to... You didn't have unlimited long distance. So I still have all those letters, and they've included recipes and what they were sewing. And I just really appreciate, John, what you're saying, and I'm glad there's somebody else out there besides me that believes in sending a stamp every now and then.
I'm glad, Mary Ann. Thanks for calling, John.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that about long distance, because one of the things that I discovered in my research was how expensive long distance was until quite recently, and how that change happened quite close to the arrival of email and all these other electronic forms of communication. And it does feel like we've suddenly gone from one world and doing one way of communicating to another way. So suddenly it's almost like we've fallen off a cliff. And the other thing I thought about while you were talking was, we all have computer crashes, we lose our correspondence, but letters are a kind of form of personal history. I mean, I was thinking of the previous caller, and someday if they have children, that those letters will be a gold mine. I mean, because there are parts of their parents that they'll see in that their parents probably can never show them. And it's the same thing with your family.
That's
of all
lovely.
These letters.
You know, my husband and I went back to our farm in northeastern Pennsylvania a few years ago and went through all the letters his father had written from the Second World War to his mother. And they were a pile. Just extraordinary letters talking about not only what he was doing, but their relationship and helping us to better understand that relationship in ways we could never have before. Let's go now to Rockford, Illinois. Good morning, Gregory.
Yes, good morning. I just would like to make three quick points because I think Mr. Freeman reveals a more fundamental problem in our entire learning process in this country now. First of all, greater access is not greater knowledge or truth. It's just greater access. We need time to reflect and think and not just absorb. And secondly, what we have to do here, what he's talking about, is we have to reengage the traditional patterns of neural integration that were of the human nervous system that have been traditionally present and effective throughout human history, which includes reading, thinking, writing, speaking, and acting, not just simply watching and listening. And thirdly, I remember what Jerry Mander, an author, wrote in a book he had published several years ago called Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television, in which he said there was no such thing as a neutral technology. And he meant that both electronically and intellectually. And what he meant to say is that it created its own environment and effect, essentially its own paradigm, which when in relation to Huxley, he said that Huxley knew that you did not have to have a controller in order to control people. All you had to do was limit their perspective to a specific or predetermined paradigm, and the deal was done. It was
such interesting points. We'll take just a short break, Gregory. If you'd like to stay on the line, John Freeman can talk about your points when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
An estimated 1 in 10 Americans have been exposed to drinking water that contains dangerous chemicals or fails to meet federal health standards in other ways. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Charles Duhigg about his alarming but enlightening New York Times series, Toxic Waters. It's based on documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
John Freeman is with me. He's the brand new editor of the magazine, the literary magazine, Granta. He's also the author of a brand new book. It's titled The Tyranny of Email, The 4,000-Year Journey to Your Inbox. And just before the break, Gregory out in Rockford, Illinois, was raising some really good points, John. The whole notion that you have raised, that the written word surely gives us more time to reflect, for example.
Yeah, those were fascinating points because actually critical thinkers of the 60s, including Marshall McLuhan, who was sort of a cult figure at some point, were thinking along these lines, which is how is the media that we're ingesting reorganizing our minds and the sort of chemical nature of how our minds work. He made a very interesting point about how neural patterns work and how we learn. And I believe quite firmly that we can't change the biology of our minds as fast as our technology can progress. And so we have this idea now that we can multitask. We can do 5 things at once. But every study that's been done on this has shown that, yes, we can improve very slightly the way our mind multitasks, but the technology is far outstripping the sort of evolution of our brains. And it used to be, you know, Ben Franklin wrote that students, kids growing up, should learn to write letters as a way to argue and express themselves and think. Now I think we have this idea that we can look at images and we can react and we can do very short, episodic types of communication, and that can substitute. But any type of deep thinking requires time. It requires a certain distance from the topic. And it requires writing. Writing is the primary mode in which we can learn.
Gregory ended up by saying, there is no such thing as a neutral technology. How do you think email has affected us?
Well, most people who work in an office will spend 40% of their day writing and responding to emails. They'll be sending and receiving 200 if the research is borne out. So that means our days are now chopped up into tiny little bits of attention. We're reacting because this information, these emails are coming in so quickly. And I think that doesn't end at the end of our day. You'll be jostled and jarred all day long, and you can't just simply shut off. And the brain can become quite addicted, actually, literally, to that stimulus. And so people come home, and even though they don't necessarily have to, they'll check their email because it's what they've been doing for 9 hours a day.
Absolutely. Now, thanks for your call, Gregory. Such informative questions. Here's an email from Damon with another perspective. He says, in the early 19th century, you could find people who inveighed against the novel. It was emasculating, encouraging too much emotion, and on and on. I guess every new technology needs its Luddites. Has your guest never written a long email to a family member? I have, he says. This nostalgia for postal mail is bizarre. Similarly, complaints about email can be turned on their heads. Yes, I've had computer crashes, but I've also lost countless paper documents in moves or basement floods. I just wish there was a little bit of reflection on the part of your guest about the many ways that email is used.
I think email is wonderful. I didn't write this book because I don't want people to use email at all, because email has so many efficient and wonderful functions to it. You can send floor plans if you're looking at a house, and you can write very quickly across enormous distances of time. Even when a family member dies, an email sent to them almost immediately is incredibly intimate and personal. So this book is not a sort of Luddite's Bible. I'm not saying don't use email, don't text. I'm saying use other forms of communication. As far as nostalgia, I think our bodies are biologically tuned toward an organic world. Think about the way that we used to read. For the most part, it was light coming down, bouncing off a piece of paper, and into our eyes. And I don't think there's anything wrong with suggesting that living in a world in which most of our time is spent looking at a screen all day long, which is beaming light directly into our eyes, is a fundamental shift. I think biologically and sort of metaphysically, there's something different about that. Light is the first thing created in the Bible. It is throughout Homer's Odyssey. It's in the Quran. Light is sort of a sacred thing, and we're living now in an era of electronic light. I don't say this to be esoteric or anything, but I do think that's a huge shift. As far as some of his other points about the novel and email being similar, I think that's a stretch, because the novel is not a form of technology. As soon as we start to say that a book is a piece of technology, I think we're entering a world and a paradigm in which everything that we create is a technology. That's not true. Technology is just one type of thing that we create. And the novel did not have the I'm going to use a technology term here, penetration that email does. I mean, there is 35 trillion emails sent this year. There's
35 trillion.
Trillion. In the time that we've been speaking, there's probably been several billion emails bouncing back and forth. People do not spend their entire days reading novels in the way that we're spending our entire days writing and receiving emails. So there's a much bigger shift happening here.
One of our listeners, Philip, wants to know, what is your take on Twitter? It seems it allows for a misdirection of time spent. If we're looking for slow communication, Twitter does not let us look at the world around us and digest all that's there, as we might miss something and are on to the next thread. For that reason, I do not subscribe. I do, though, cherish the feel of pen and paper and the connection with the person who wrote to me.
I totally agree. I mean, I think having that sense of being in a one-to-one communication is so important. And we live now in a world where so many forms of our written technology, like email or Twitter or Facebook, they're broadcast technology. Not all of us are broadcasters, but we would like to be. So we'd like to talk to thousands of people at once. But if everybody wants to talk to thousands of people at once, no one's listening.
Do you use Twitter?
I do use Twitter for Granta, because I think the thing that Twitter is quite good for is for organizing group behavior. So, for example, people don't read the news the same way, obviously, anymore. They hunt and peck. They choose. They sort of shop for news, whatever metaphor you want to use. And so we put up a news story on Granta's website every day. And I know that people won't necessarily go there every day because there's so much noise about the media. So we tweet out to our followers. And for people who are trying to sift, Twitter can be very good because you can check it once a day, see the threads of the people you're following, as long as you're following kind of a manageable number of people, and go there. The other thing that we use Twitter for, which is quite effective, is we planned about 100 events around the U.S. this year, readings, parties at independent bookstores, that kind of thing, because I think we have to have a real-world component to Internet activity for the Internet activity to matter. So we tweet out whenever we have a party or an event in a different city, and sometimes that brings people in.
The other element that I use for communication with my grandchildren is Skype, using the computer as a telephone with visual elements, which allows me to see their faces as they talk.
Oh, I love. I mean, I really believe in that because I spend half the year living and working in London, and my girlfriend lives in New York. And so often, at the end of the day, we'll just turn it on, and talk for a bit, and then leave it on and watch TV together.
John Freeman, his new book is titled "The Tyranny of Email," and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Indianapolis. Good morning, Eddie. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
This is a great subject. I'd just like to share a story. Back in January, I went on a mission trip to Southeast Asia, and I was in Burma, Cambodia, and Thailand. And on the Burma part of the trip, I did not have access to email. So at night, for about 10 nights, I would write a letter to my wife every night, her picture right next to me, and I would just write to her. And it was such a powerful experience, and when I got home, I was able to read that letter to her when I got home, and it's just such a powerful experience. And I just wanted to share that with everyone today. Thank you.
That's lovely. Thank you, Eddie.
That's terrific. I mean, the other thing I thought you were going to say was that I kept a journal. And the thing about instant communication, about traveling and you see an internet cafe or something, is you write these sort of blips and blabs, but you have no record of it unless you sort of collect everything that's in your sent box and put it together. And when you write something slowly as you're experiencing it, I think it helps you remember it in a way that if you're simply sort of having these short bits of communication, it becomes even more ephemeral.
My husband and I are about to celebrate our 50th wedding anniversary this December. And the other day, I was looking through some journals of mine and found the journal I kept when we took our 25th wedding anniversary trip to Italy. And reading through all that just brought it all back again.
Well, you probably felt, did you feel like a stranger to yourself at a distance, or did it seem very familiar?
Both. Both.
I love reading writers' journals because, A, it's so intimate, but there's also that you get to experience Joyce Carol Oates' journals, which were published two, three years ago, were phenomenal because you watched her think and watched her kind of logic through these different experiences. I mean, her family would visit and she would describe it and in such a beautiful way that it felt like something that you'd experience yourself.
We have an email from Tracy who's wondering how much of an effect, if any, do you feel that chat speak like LOL, BRB, CU, LADAR, etc. has had on society today?
Well, linguists are kind of divided over this. There's a guy named David Crystal who's a really prominent linguist who's written over 100 books who isn't critical of the language and the style, the use of English in texting. And I think the general discussion happens around, is it a visual language or is it a written language? And I think in some ways, the combination of sort of visual cues in email speak and in chat speak is not such a bad thing because it reminds us that what we're writing is not a letter. It's not a long document. This is something that needs to move quickly and therefore has abbreviations. And so I think to some extent that stuff is very useful. But, you know, a lot of emails come with misspellings and typos. And the more that we rely on a computer to correct ourselves, the harder it is. I mean, if you go to write a letter now, you think, wait, how do I spell that?
Yeah, right, right.
That's, I think, where it gets trickier.
To Glee in Long Island, New York, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Diana. It is a pleasure to be on the show with you.
I'm so glad you're here.
I want to thank your guest, John. What an amazing, I can't wait to read your book. I'm thrilled.
Thank you.
This has been a topic that's been very close to my heart. I guess you'd call me a traditionalist because I really don't enjoy doing email. I don't do that much on the computer. I enjoy writing notes and cards. And I share the same kind of memories with my grandmother, who was an avid writer. I remember camp, she'd send me these 3- and 4-page letters that were such a treat and such a gift to receive when I was at camp. And as I got older, she continued to write me when she'd go overseas on her travels. It was just really a privilege to witness, you know, what she was walking through when she'd share in great detail her travels. I wanted to bring up the subject of children in this day and age. And I have 3 small boys, 8, 10, and 12. And my concern is that, you know, it's almost a lost art to write. And I encourage my kids to write thank you notes and letters to their grandparents and so on and so forth. But it really is difficult to get them to sit down and do it. You know, I think that it's so easy to get caught up in all the, like you said, the speed of it all.
Sure.
You know, it's funny that one of the things I've struggled with this book is it's sort of moving against the grain because the speed at which our culture moves, it suggests that the thing to do if you want to change behavior is not to write a book, but to start a Twitter campaign or to, you know, have a kind of email round robin campaign or to go on television. But I do feel like you can, if you are persistent enough, carve out just enough time for kids to learn to write and then to learn to enjoy it.
I want to read you one last email from Kathy, who says, my husband has written a postcard to me every single day since we first met in 1996. I have boxes of them and love the written words. I can reread any time. He says things to me in those postcards. I wish he'd tell me in person, but I now feel so grateful for my mailbox love notes. Isn't that marvelous?
That's incredible.
It's just terrific. And a wonderful reminder of how important the written word is. John Freeman, thank you for your book.
Oh, thanks for having me on here.
The book is titled The Tyranny of Email, The 4,000-Year Journey to Your Inbox. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.